Leto said. Moneo dared to hope. He lifted his gaze to the God Emperor's face, noting that the eyes were not glazed, and the hands were not trembling. Perhaps the worm did not come. Religious institutions perpetuate a mortal master-servant relationship, Leto said. They create an arena which attracts prideful human power-seekers with all of their near-sighted prejudices. Moneo could only nod. Was that a trembling in the God Emperor's hands? Was the terrible face withdrawing slightly into its cowl? The secret revelations of infamy. That is what the Duncans ask after, Leto said. The Duncans have too much compassion for their fellows and too sharp a limit on fellowship. Moneo had studied hollows of Dune's ancient sandworms, the gigantic mouths full of crisp knife teeth around consuming fire. He noted the tumescence of the latent rings on Leto's tubular surface. Were they more prominent? Would a new mouth open below that cowled face? The Duncans know in their hearts, Leto said, that I have deliberately ignored the admonition of Mohammed and Moses. Even you know it, Moneo. It was an accusation. Moneo started to nod, then shook his head from side to side. He wondered if he dared renew his retreat. Moneo knew from experience that lectures in this tenor did not long continue without the coming of the worm. What might that admonition be? Leto asked. There was a mocking lightness in his voice. Moneo allowed himself a faint shrug. Abruptly, Leto's voice filled the chamber with a rumbling baritone, an ancient voice which spoke across the centuries.
You are servants unto God, not servants unto servants.
Moneo wrung his hands and cried out,
I serve you, Lord.
Moneo, Moneo, Leto said,
his voice low and resonant.
A million wrongs cannot give rise to one right. The right is known because it endures.
Moneo could only stand in trembling silence.
I had intended Hui to mate with you, Moneo, Leto said. Now it is too late.
The words took a moment, penetrating Moneo's consciousness. He felt that their meaning was out of any known context.
Hui? Who is Hui? Oh, yes, the God Emperor's Ixion bride-to-be. Mate? With me?
Moneo shook his head. Leto spoke with infinite sadness.
You too shall pass away. Will all your works be as dust forgotten?
Without any warning, even as he spoke, Leto's body convulsed in a thrashing roll which heaved him from the cart. The speed of it, the monstrous violence, threw him within centimeters of Moneo, who screamed and fled across the crypt.
Moneo!
Leto's call stopped the majordomo at the entrance to the lift.
The test, Moneo! I will test Siona tomorrow.
The realization of what I am occurs in the timeless awareness which does not simulate nor delude. I create a field without self or center, a field where even death becomes only analogy. I desire no results. I merely permit this field, which has no goals nor desires, no perfections nor even visions of achievements. In that field, omnipresent primal awareness is all. It is the light which pours through the windows of my universe. The Stolen Journals.
The sun came up, sending its harsh glare across the dunes. Leto felt the sand beneath him as a soft caress. Only his human ears, hearing the abrasive rasp of his heavy body, reported otherwise. It was a sensory conflict which he had learned to accept. He heard Siona walking behind him, a lightness in her tread, a gentle spilling of sand as she climbed to his level atop a dune.
The longer I endure, the more vulnerable I become, he thought.
This thought often occurred to him these days when he went into his desert. He peered upward. The sky was cloudless, with a blue density which the old days of Dune had never seen. What was a desert without a cloudless sky? Too bad it could not have Dune's silvery hue. Ixion satellites controlled this sky, not always to the perfection he might desire. Such perfection was a machine fantasy which faltered under human management. Still, the satellites held a sufficiently steady grip to give him this morning of desert stillness. He gave his human lungs a deep breath of it and listened for Siona's approach. She had stopped. He knew she was admiring the view. Leto felt his imagination like a conjurer calling up everything which had produced the physical setting for this moment. He felt the satellites, fine instruments which played the music for the dance of warming and cooling air masses, perpetually monitoring and adjusting the powerful vertical and horizontal currents. It amused him to recall that the Ixians had thought he would use this exquisite machinery in a new kind of hydraulic despotism, withholding moisture from those who defied their ruler, punishing others with terrible storms. How surprised they had been to find themselves mistaken. My controls are more subtle. Slowly, gently, he began to move, swimming on the sand surface, gliding down off the dune, never once looking back at the thin spire of his tower, knowing that it would vanish presently into the haze of daytime heat. Siona followed him with an uncharacteristic docility. Doubt had done its work. She had read the stolen journals. She had listened to the admonitions of her father. Now she did not know what to think. What is this test? She had asked Moneo. What will he do?
It is never the same.
How did he test you?
It will be different with you. I would only confuse you if I told you my experience.
Leto had listened secretly while Moneo prepared his daughter, dressed her in an authentic Fremen stillsuit with a dark robe over it, fitting the boot pumps correctly. Moneo had not forgotten. Moneo had looked up from where he bent to adjust her boots.
The worm will come. That is all I can tell you. You must find a way to live in the presence of the worm.
He had stood then, explaining about the stillsuit, how it recycled her body's own waters. He made her pull the tube from a catch pocket and suck on it, then reseal the tube.
You will be alone with him on the desert, Moneo had said. Shai Hulud is never far away when you're on the desert.
What if I refuse to go? She asked.
You will go, but you may not return.
This conversation had occurred in the ground-level chamber of the little citadel while Leto waited in the eyrie. He had come down when he knew Siona was ready, drifting down in the pre-dawn darkness of his cart's suspensers. The cart had gone into the ground-level room after Moneo and Siona emerged. While Moneo marched across the flat ground to his thopter and left in a whispering of wings, Leto had required Siona to test the sealed portal of the ground-level chamber, then look upward at the tower's impossible heights. The only way out is across the sarir, he said. He led her away from the tower then, not even commanding her to follow, depending on her good sense, her curiosity, and her doubts. Leto's swimming progress took him down the dune's slip face and onto an exposed section of the rocky basement complex, then up another sandy face at a shallow angle, creating a path for Siona to follow. Fremen had called such compression tracks God's gift to the weary. He moved slowly, giving Siona plenty of time in which to recognize that this was his domain, his natural habitat. He came out atop another dune and turned to watch her progress. She held to the track he had provided and stopped only when she reached the top. Her glance went once to his face, then she turned a full circle to examine the horizon. He heard the sharp intake of her breath. Heat haze hid the spire's top. The base might have been a distant outcropping.
This is how it was, he said.
There was something about the desert which spoke to the eternal soul of people who possessed Fremen blood, he knew. He had chosen this place for its desert impact, a dune slightly higher than the others.
Take a good look at it, he said,
and he slipped down the dune's other side to remove his bulk from her view. Siona took one more slow turn, looking outward. Leto knew the innermost sensation of what she saw. Except for that insignificant, blurred blip of his tower's base, there was not the slightest lift of horizon. Flat. Everywhere flat. No plants, no living movement. From her vantage, There was a limit of approximately 8 kilometers to the line where the planet's curvature hid everything beyond. Leto spoke from where he had stopped, just below the dune's crest.
This is the real Sarir. You only know it when you're down here afoot. This is all that's left of the Bar Belama.
The ocean without water, she whispered.
Again she turned and examined the entire horizon. There was no wind, and Leto knew without wind the silence ate at the human soul. Siona was feeling the loss of all familiar reference points. She was abandoned in dangerous space. Leto glanced at the next dune. In that direction they would come presently to a low line of hills, which originally had been mountains, but now were broken into remnant slag and rubble. He continued to rest quietly, letting the silence do his work for him. It was even pleasant to imagine that these dunes went on, as they once had, without end, completely around the planet, but even these few dunes were degenerating. Without the original Coriolis storms of dune, the Sarir saw nothing stronger than a stiff breeze and occasional heat vortices, which had no more than local effect. One of these tiny wind devils danced across the middle distance to the south. Siona's gaze followed its track. She spoke abruptly.
Do you have a personal religion?
Leto took a moment composing his reply. It always astonished him how a desert provoked thoughts of religion.
You dare ask me if I have a personal religion? He demanded.
Betraying no surface sign of the fears he knew she felt, Siona turned and stared down at him. Audacity was always an Atreides hallmark, he reminded himself. When she didn't answer, he said,
You are an Atreides for sure.
Is that your answer? She asked.
What is it you really want to know, Siona?
What you believe.
Oh, you ask after my faith. Well now, I believe that something cannot emerge from nothing without divine intervention.
His answer puzzled her.
How is that?
Natura non facit saltus, he said.
She shook her head, not understanding the ancient allusion which had sprung to his lips. Leto translated,
Nature makes no leaps.
What language was that? She asked.
A language no longer spoken anywhere else in my universe.
Why did you use it then?
To prod your ancient memories.
I don't have any. I just need to know why you brought me here.
To give you a taste of your past. Come down here and climb onto my back.
She hesitated at first, then, seeing the futility of defiance, slid down the dune and clambered onto his back. Leto waited until she was kneeling atop him. It was not the same as the old times, he knew. She had no maker hooks and could not stand on his back. He lifted his front segments slightly off the surface.
Why am I doing this? She asked.
Her tone said she felt silly up there.
I want you to taste the way our people once moved proudly across this land, high atop the back of a giant sandworm.
He began to glide along the dune just below the crest. Siona had seen hollows. She knew this experience intellectually, but the pulse of reality had a different beat, and he knew she would resonate to it.
Ah, Siona, he thought, you do not even begin to suspect how I will test you.
Leto steeled himself then.
I must have no pity. If she dies, she dies. If any of them dies, that is a required event, no more.
And he had to remind himself that this applied even to Hui Nori. It was just that all of them could not die. He sensed it when Siona began to enjoy the sensation of riding on his back. He felt a faint shift in her weight as she eased back onto her legs to lift her head. He drove outward then along a curving barakan, joining Siona in enjoyment of the old sensations. Leto could just glimpse the remnant hills at the horizon ahead of him. They were like a seed from the past waiting there, a reminder of the self-sustaining and expanding force which operated in a desert. He could forget for a moment that on this planet, where only a small fraction of the surface remained desert, the Sarir's dynamism existed in a precarious environment. The illusion of the past was here, though. He felt it as he moved. Fantasy, of course, he told himself, a vanishing fantasy as long as his enforced tranquility continued. Even the sweeping barakan which he traversed now was not as great as the ones of the past. None of the dunes were that great. This whole maintained desert struck him suddenly as ridiculous. He almost stopped on a pebbled surface between the dunes, continuing but more slowly as he tried to conjure up the necessities which kept the whole system working. He imagined the planet's rotation setting up great air currents, which shifted cold and heated air to new regions in enormous volume, everything monitored and ruled by those tiny satellites with their Ixian instruments and heat-focusing dishes. If the high monitors saw anything, they saw the Sarir partly as a relief desert, with both physical and cold air walls girdling it. This tended to create ice at the edges, and required even more climatic adjustments. It was not easy, and Leto forgave the occasional mistakes for that reason. As he moved once more out onto dunes, he lost that sense of delicate balance, put aside memories of the pebbly wastelands outside the central sands, and gave himself up to enjoyment of his petrified ocean with its frozen and apparently immovable waves. He turned southward, parallel to the remnant hills. He knew that most people were offended by his infatuation with desert. They were uneasy and turned away. Siona, however, could not turn away. Everywhere she looked, the desert demanded recognition. She rode silently on his back, but he knew her eyes were full, and the old, old memories were beginning to churn. He came within 3 hours to a region of cylindrical whaleback dunes, some of them more than 150 kilometers long at an angle to the prevailing wind. Beyond them lay a rocky corridor between dunes and into a region of star dunes almost 400 meters high. Finally, they entered the braided dunes of the central erg, where the general high pressure and electrically charged air gave his spirits a lift. He knew the same magic would be working on Siona. "Here is where the songs of the Long Trek originated," he said. "They are perfectly preserved in the oral history." She did not answer, but he knew she heard. Leto slowed his pace and began to speak to Siona, telling her about their Fremen past. He sensed the quickening of her interest. She even asked questions occasionally, but he could also feel her fears building. Even the base of his little citadel was no longer visible here. She could recognize nothing man-made, and she would think he engaged now in small talk, unimportant things to put off something portentous. "Equality between our men and women originated here," he said.
"Your fish speakers deny that men and women are equal," she said.
Her voice, full of questioning disbelief, was a better locator than the sensation of her crouched on his back. Leto stopped at the intersection of two braided dunes and let the venting of his heat-generated oxygen subside.
"Things are not the same today," he said. "But men and women do have different evolutionary demands upon them. With the Fremen, though, there was an interdependence. That fostered equality out here where questions of survival can become immediate."
"Why did you bring me here?" she demanded.
"Look behind us," he said.
He felt her turn. Presently, she said,
"What am I supposed to see?"
"Have we left any tracks? Can you tell where we've been?"
"There's a little wind now."
"It has covered our tracks?"
"I guess so. Yes."
"This desert made us what we were and are," he said. "It's the real museum of all our traditions. Not one of those traditions has really been lost."
Leto saw a small sandstorm, a Ghibli, moving across the southern horizon. He noted the narrow ribbons of dust and sand moving out ahead of it. Surely Siona had seen it.
"Why won't you tell me why you brought me here?" she asked.
Fear was obvious in her voice.
"But I have told you."
"You have not."
"How far have we come, Siona?"
She thought about this.
30 kilometers? 20?
"Farther," he said. "I can move very fast in my own land. Didn't you feel the wind on your face?"
"Yes."
Sullen.
"So why ask me how far?"
"Come down and stand where I can see you."
"Why?"
"Good," he thought. "She believes I will abandon her here and speed off faster than she can follow. Come down and I'll explain," he said.
She slid off his back and came around to where she could look into his face.
"Time passes swiftly when your senses are full," he said. "We have been out almost 4 hours.
We have come about 60 kilometers.
Why is that important?
Moneo put dried food in the pouch of your robe, he said. Eat a little and I will tell you. She found a dried cube of protomore in the pouch and chewed on it while she watched him. It was the authentic old Fremen food, even to the slight addition of melange. You have felt your past, he said. Now you must be sensitized to your future, to the golden path. She swallowed.
I don't believe in your golden path.
If you are to live, you will believe in it.
Is that your test? Have faith in the great god Leto or die?
You need no faith in me whatsoever. I want you to have faith in yourself.
Then why is it important how far we've come?
So you'll understand how far you still have to go.
She put a hand to her cheek. I don't.
Right where you stand, he said. You are in the unmistakable midst of infinity. Look around you at the meaning of infinity. She glanced left and right at the unbroken desert. We are going to walk out of my desert together, he said, just the two of us.
You don't walk,
she sneered, a figure of speech, but you will walk. I assure you of that.
She looked in the direction they had come. So that's why you asked me about tracks.
Even if there were tracks, you could not go back. There is nothing at my little citadel that you could get to and use for survival.
No water?
Nothing.
She found the catch pocket tube at her shoulder, sucked at it, and restored it. He noted the care with which she sealed the end, but she did not pull the face flap across her mouth, although Leto had heard her father warning her about this. She wanted her mouth free for talking.
You're telling me I can't run away from you,
she said.
Run away if you want.
She turned a full circle, examining the wasteland.
There is a saying about the open land, he said, that one direction is as good as another. In some ways that's still true, but I would not depend on it.
But I'm really free to leave you if I want.
Freedom can be a very lonely estate, he said.
She pointed to the steep side of the dune on which they had stopped.
But I could just go down there and—
Were I you, Siona, I would not go down where you are pointing.
She glared at him.
Why?
On the dune's steep side, unless you follow the natural curves, the sand may slide down upon you and bury you.
She looked down the slope, absorbing this.
See how beautiful words can be? He asked.
She returned her attention to his face.
Should we be going?
You learn to value leisure out here. And courtesy. There's no hurry.
But we have no water except the—
Used wisely, that stillsuit will keep you alive.
But how long will it take us to—
Your impatience alarms me.
But we have only this dried food in my pouch. What will we eat when—
Siona, have you noticed that you are expressing our situation as mutual? What will we eat? We have no water. Should we be going? How long will it take us?
He sensed the dryness of her mouth as she tried to swallow.
Could it be that we're interdependent? He asked.
She spoke reluctantly.
I don't know how to survive out here.
But I do.
She nodded.
Why should I share such precious knowledge with you? He asked.
She shrugged, a pitiful gesture which touched him. How quickly the desert cut away previous attitudes.
I will share my knowledge with you, he said, and you must find something valuable that you can share with me.
Her gaze traversed his length, paused a moment at the flippers which once were his legs and feet, then came back to his face.
Agreement bought with threats is no agreement, she said.
I offer you no violence.
There are many kinds of violence,
she said.
And I brought you out here where you may die?
Did I have a choice in it?
It is difficult to be born an Atreides, he said. Believe me, I know.
You don't have to do it this way, she said.
And there you are wrong.
He turned away from her and set off in a sinusoidal track down the dune. He heard her slipping and stumbling as she followed. Leto stopped well into the dune shadow.
We'll wait out the day here, he said. It uses less water to travel by night.
One of the most terrible words in any language is soldier. The synonyms parade through our history. Yagani, trooper, hussar, karibo, cossack, deranzif, legionnaire, sardaukar, fish speaker. I know them all. They stand there in the ranks of my memory to remind me, always make sure you have the army with you. The Stolen Journals.
Idaho found Moneo at last in the long underground corridor which connected the Citadel's eastern and western complexes. Since daybreak 2 hours before, Idaho had been prowling the Citadel seeking the Major Domo, and there he was, far off down the corridor talking to someone concealed in a doorway. But Moneo was recognizable even at this distance by his stance and that inevitable white uniform. The corridor's plass-stone walls were amber here, 50 meters below the surface, and lighted by glow strips keyed to the daylight hours. Cool breezes were drawn into these depths by a simple arrangement of free-swinging wings which stood like gigantic robed figures on perimeter towers at the surface. Now that the sun had warmed the sands, all of the wings pointed northward for the cool air pouring into the sarir. Idaho smelled the flinty breeze as he walked. He knew what this corridor was supposed to represent. It did have some characteristics of an ancient Fremen siege. The corridor was wide, big enough to take Leto on his cart. The arched ceiling looked like rock, but the twin glow strips were discord. Idaho had never seen glow strips before coming to the Citadel. They had been considered impractical in his day, requiring too much energy, too costly to maintain. Glow globes were simpler and easily replaced. He had come to realize, however, that Leto considered few things impractical. What Leto wants, someone provides. The thought had an ominous feeling as Idaho marched down the corridor toward Moneo. Small rooms lined the corridor Sietch fashion. No doors, only thin hangings of russet fabric which swayed in the breeze. Idaho knew that this area was mostly quarters for the younger fish speakers. He had recognized an assembly chamber with attendant rooms for weapons storage, kitchen, a dining hall, maintenance shops. He had also seen other things behind the inadequate privacy of the hangings, things which fed his rage. Moneo turned at Idaho's approach. The woman to whom Moneo had been talking retreated and let the hanging drop, but not before Idaho glimpsed an older face with an air of command about it. Idaho did not recognize that particular commander. Moneo nodded as Idaho stopped 2 paces away.
"The guards say you've been looking for me," Moneo said.
"Where is he, Moneo?"
"Where is who?"
Moneo swept his gaze up and down Idaho's figure, noting the old-fashioned Atreides uniform, black with a red hawk at the breast, the high boots glistening with polish. There was a ritual look about the man. Idaho took a shallow breath and spoke through clenched teeth.
"Don't you start that game with me."
Moneo took his attention away from the sheathed knife at Idaho's waist. It looked like a museum piece with its jeweled handle. Where had Idaho found it?
"If you mean the God Emperor," Moneo said.
"Where?"
Moneo kept his voice mild.
"Why are you so anxious to die?"
"They said you were with him."
"That was earlier."
"I'll find him, Moneo."
"Not right now."
Idaho put a hand on his knife.
"Do I have to use force to make you talk?"
"I would not advise that."
"Where is he?"
"Since you insist, he is out in the desert with Siona."
"With your daughter?"
"Is there another Siona?"
"What are they doing?"
"She is being tested."
"When will they return?"
Moneo shrugged, then,
"Why this unseemly anger, Duncan?"
"What's this test of your—"
"I don't know. Now, why are you so upset?"
"I'm sick of this place. Fish speakers."
He turned his head and spat. Moneo glanced down the corridor behind Idaho, recalling the man's approach. Knowing the Duncans, it was easy to recognize what had fed his current rage.
"Duncan," Moneo said, "it's perfectly normal for adolescent females, as well as males, to have feelings of physical attraction toward members of their own sex. Most of them will grow out of it."
"It should be stamped out."
"But it's part of our heritage."
"Stamped out, and that's not—"
"Oh, be still. If you try to suppress it, you only increase its power."
Idaho glared at him.
And you say you don't know what's going on up there with your own daughter?
Siona is being tested, I told you.
And what's that supposed to mean?
Moneo put a hand over his eyes and sighed. He lowered the hand, wondering why he put up with this foolish, dangerous, antique human.
It means that she may die out there.
Idaho was taken aback, some of his anger cooling.
How can you allow... Allow? You think I have a choice?
Every man has a choice.
A bitter smile flitted across Moneo's lips.
How is it that you are so much more foolish than the other Duncans?
Other Duncans,
Idaho said. How did those others die, Moneo?
The way we all die. They ran out of time.
You lie!
Idaho spoke past gritted teeth, his knuckles white on the knife handle. Still speaking mildly, Moneo said,
Have a care. There are limits even to what I will take, especially just now.
This place is rotten, Idaho said.
He gestured with his free hand at the corridor behind him.
There are some things I'll never accept.
Moneo stared down the empty corridor without seeing.
You must, Mature Duncan. You must.
Idaho's hand tensed on the knife.
What does that mean?
These are sensitive times. Anything unsettling to him, anything must be prevented.
Idaho held himself on the edge of violence, his anger restrained only by something puzzling in Moneo's manner. Words had been spoken, though, which could not be ignored.
I'm not some damned immature child. You can...
Duncan!
It was the loudest sound Idaho had ever heard from the mild-mannered Moneo. Surprise stayed Idaho's hand while Moneo continued.
If the demands of your flesh are for maturity, but something holds you in adolescence, quite nasty behavior develops. Let go.
Are you accusing me of...
No!
Moneo gestured at the corridor.
Oh, I know what you must have seen back there, but it...
Two women in a passionate kiss... You think that's not...
It's not important. Youth explores its potential in many ways.
Idaho balanced himself on the edge of an explosion, rocking forward on his toes.
I'm glad to learn about you, Moneo.
Yes, well, I've learned about you several times.
Moneo watched the effect of these words as they twisted through Idaho, tangling him. The Golas could never avoid a fascination with the others who had preceded them. Idaho spoke in a hoarse whisper.
What have you learned?
You have taught me valuable things, Moneo said. All of us try to evolve, but if something blocks us, we can transfer our potential into pain, seeking it or giving it. Adolescents are particularly vulnerable.
Idaho leaned close to Moneo.
I'm talking about sex.
Of course you are.
Are you accusing me of adolescent?
That's right.
I should cut your...
Oh, shut up!
Moneo's response did not have the training nuances of Bene Gesserit voice control, but it had a lifetime of command behind it, something in Idaho could only obey.
I'm sorry, Moneo said, but I'm distracted by the fact that my only daughter...
He broke off and shrugged. Idaho inhaled two deep breaths.
You're crazy, all of you. You say your daughter may be dying, and yet you...
You fool! Moneo snapped. Have you any idea how your petty concerns appear to me? Your stupid questions and your selfish...
He broke off, shaking his head.
I make allowances because you have personal problems, Idaho said. But if you...
Allowances? You make allowances?
Moneo took a trembling breath. It was too much. Idaho spoke stiffly.
I can forgive you, your...
You prattle about sex and forgiving and pain and... You think you and Huinori...
Leave her out of this.
Oh, yes, leave her out. Leave out that pain. You share sex with her and you never think about parting. Tell me, fool, how do you give of yourself in the face of that?
Abashed, Idaho inhaled deeply. He had not suspected such passion smouldering in the quiet Moneo. But this attack, this could not be...
You think I'm cruel? Moneo demanded. I make you think about things you'd rather avoid. Ha! Crueler things have been done to the Lord later for no better reason than the cruelty.
You defend him?
I know him best.
He uses you.
To what ends?
You tell me.
He's our best hope to perpetuate.
Perverts don't perpetuate.
Moneo spoke in a soothing tone, but his words shook Idaho.
I will tell you this only once. Homosexuals have been among the best warriors in our history, the berserkers of last resort. They were among our best priests and priestesses. Celibacy was no accident in religions. It is also no accident that adolescents make the best soldiers.
That's perversion.
Quite right. Military commanders have known about the perverted displacement of sex into pain for thousands upon thousands of centuries.
Is that what the great Lord Leto's doing?
Still mild, Moneo said,
Violence requires that you inflict pain and suffer it. How much more manageable a military force driven to this by its deepest urgings.
He's made a monster out of you, too.
You suggested that he uses me, Moneo said. I permit this because I know that the price he pays is much greater than what he demands of me.
Even your daughter?
He holds nothing back. Why should I? Oh, I think you understand this about the Atreides. The Duncans are always good at that.
The Duncans! Damn you, I won't be—
You just haven't the guts to pay the price he's asking,
Moneo said. In one blurred motion, Idaho whipped his knife from its sheath and lunged at Moneo. As fast as he moved, Moneo moved faster, sidestepping, tripping Idaho and propelling him face down onto the floor. Idaho scrambled forward, rolled, and started to leap to his feet, then hesitated, realizing that he had actually tried to attack an Atreides. Moneo was Atreides. Shock held Idaho immobile. Moneo stood unmoving, looking down at him. There was an odd look of sadness on the majordomo's face.
If you're going to kill me, Duncan, you'd best do it in the back, by stealth, Moneo said. You might succeed that way.
Idaho levered himself to one knee, put a foot flat on the floor, but remained there, still clutching his knife. Moneo had moved so quickly, and with such grace, so casually. Idaho cleared his throat.
How did you—
He has been breeding us for a long time, Duncan, strengthening many things in us. He has bred us for speed, for intelligence, for self-restraint, for sensitivity. You're just an older model.
Do you know what guerrillas often say? They claim that their rebellions are invulnerable to economic warfare because they have no economy, that they are parasitic on those they would overthrow. The fools merely fail to assess the coin in which they must inevitably pay. The pattern is inexorable in its degenerative failures. You see it repeated in the systems of slavery, of welfare states, of caste-ridden religions, of socializing bureaucracies, in any system which creates and maintains dependencies. Too long a parasite, and you cannot exist without a host. The Stolen Journals.
Leto and Siona lay all day in the dune shadows, moving only as the sun moved. He taught her how to protect herself under a blanket of sand in the noontime heat. It never grew too warm at the rock level between the dunes. In the afternoon, Siona crept close to Leto for warmth, a warmth he knew he had in excess these days. They talked sporadically. He told her about the Fremen graces which once had dominated this landscape. She probed for secret knowledge of him. Once he said,
You may find it odd, but out here is where I can be most human.
His words failed to make her fully conscious of her human vulnerability and the fact that she might die out here. Even when she was not talking, she did not restore the face flap of her stillsuit. Leto recognized the unconscious motivation behind this failure, but knew the futility of addressing that directly. In the late afternoon, night's chill already starting to creep over the land, he began regaling her with songs of the long trek which had not been saved in the oral history. He enjoyed the fact that she liked one of his favorites, Liet's march. The tune is really ancient, he said, a pre-space thing of old terror.
Would you sing it again?
He chose one of his best baritones, a long-dead artist who had filled many a concert hall.
The wall of past beyond recall hides me from an ancient fall where all the waters tumble, and plays of sprays carve caves in clays beneath a torrent's rumble.
When he had finished, she was silent for a moment, then,
"That's an odd song for marching."
"They liked it because they could dissect it," he said.
"Dissect?"
"Before our Fremen ancestors came to this planet, night was the time for storytelling, songs, and poetry. In the Dune days, though, that was reserved for the false dark, the daytime gloom of the Sietch. The night was when they could emerge and move about, just as we do now."
"But you said dissect."
"What does that song mean?" he asked.
"Oh, it's just a song."
"Siona."
She heard anger in his voice and remained silent.
"This planet is the child of the worm," he warned her, "and I am that worm."
She responded with a surprising insouciance.
"Then tell me what it means."
"The insect has no more freedom from its hive than we have freedom from our past," he said. "The caves are there, and all of the messages written in the sprays of the torrents."
"I prefer dancing songs," she said.
It was a flippant answer, but Leto chose to take it as a change of subject. He told her about the marriage dance of Fremen women, tracing the steps back to the whirling of dust devils. Leto prided himself on telling a good story. It was clear from her rapt attention that she could see the women whirling before her inner eye, long black hair thrown in the ancient movements, straggling across long dead faces. Darkness was almost upon them when he finished.
"Come," he said. "Morning and evening are still the times of silhouettes. Let us see if anyone shares our desert."
Siona followed him up to a dune crest, and they stared all around at the darkening desert. There was only one bird high overhead, attracted by their movements. From the splayed gap tips on its wings and the shape, he knew it was a vulture. He pointed this out to Siona.
"But what do they eat?" she asked.
"Anything that's dead, or nearly so."
This hit her, and she stared up at the last of the sunlight gilding the lone bird's flight feathers. Leto pressed it.
"A few people still venture into my sarir. Sometimes a museum Fremen wanders off and gets lost. They're really only good at the rituals. And then there are the desert's edges, and the remains of whatever my wolves leave."
At this, she whirled away from him, but not before he saw the passion still consuming her. Siona was being sorely tested.
"There's little daytime graciousness about a desert," he said. "That's another reason we travel by night. To a Fremen, the image of the day was that of wind-blown sand filling your tracks."
Her eyes glistened with unshed tears when she turned back to him, but her features were composed.
"What lives here now?" she asked.
"The vultures, a few night creatures, an occasional remnant of plant life out of the old days, burrowing things."
"Is that all?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Because this is where they were born, and I permit them to know nothing better."
It was almost dark with that sudden glowing light his desert acquired in these moments. He studied her in that luminous moment, recognizing that she had not yet understood his other message. He knew that message would sit there, though, and fester in her.
"Silhouettes," she said, reminding him. "What did you expect to find when we came up here?"
"Perhaps people at a distance. You're never certain."
"What people?"
"I've already told you."
"What would you have done if you'd seen anyone?"
"It was the Fremen custom to treat distant people as hostile until they threw sand into the air."
As he spoke, darkness fell over them like a curtain. Siona became ghostly movement in the sudden starlight.
"Sand?" she asked.
"Thrown sand is a profound gesture. It says we share the same burden. Sand is our only enemy. This is what we drink. The hand that holds sand holds no weapon. Do you understand this?"
"No."
She taunted him with a defiant falsehood.
"You will,"
he said. Without a word, she set out along the arc of their dune, striding away from him with an angry excess of energy. Leto allowed himself to fall far behind her, interested that she had instinctively chosen the right direction. Fremen memories could be felt churning in her. Where the dune dipped to cross another, she waited for him. He saw that the face flap of her stillsuit remained open, hanging loose. It was not yet time to chide her about this. Some unconscious things had to run their natural course. As he came up to her, she said,
"Is this as good a direction as any other?"
"If you keep to it," he said. She glanced up at the stars, and he saw her identify the pointers, those Fremen arrows which had led her ancestors across this land. He could see, though, that her recognition was mostly intellectual. She had not yet come to accept the other things working within her. Leto lifted his front segments to peer ahead in the starlight. They were moving a little west of north on a track that once had led across Habanya Ridge and Cave of Birds into the Erg below False Wall West and the way to Wind Pass. None of those landmarks remained. He sniffed a cool breeze with flint smells in it and more moisture than he found pleasant. Once more Siona set off, slower this time, holding her course by occasional glances at the stars. She had trusted Leto to confirm the way, but now she guided herself. He sensed the turmoil beneath her wary thoughts, and he knew the things which were emerging. She had the beginnings of that intense loyalty to traveling companions which desert folk always trusted. "We know," he thought. "If you are separated from your companions, you are lost among dunes and rocks. The lone traveler in the desert is dead. Only the worm lives alone out here." He let her get well ahead of him, where the grating sand of her passage would not be too prominent. She had to think of his human self. He counted on loyalty to work for him. Siona was brittle, though, filled with suppressed rage, more of a rebel than any other he had ever tested. Leto glided along behind her, reviewing the breeding program, shaping the necessary decisions for a replacement should she fail. As the night progressed, Siona moved slower and slower. First moon was high overhead, and second moon well above the horizon before she stopped to rest and eat. Leto was glad of the pause. Friction had set up a worm dominance, the air around him full of the chemical exhalations from his temperature adjustments. The thing he thought of as his oxygen supercharger vented steadily, making him intensely aware of the protein factories and amino acid resources his worm self had acquired to accommodate the placental relationship with his human cells. Desert quickened the movement toward his final metamorphosis. Siona had stopped near the crest of a star dune.
"Is it true that you eat the sand?" she asked as he came up to her.
"It's true." She stared all around the moon-frosted horizon.
"Why didn't we bring a signal device?"
"I wanted you to learn about possessions." She turned toward him. He sensed her breath close to his face. She was losing too much moisture into the dry air. Still, she did not remember Moneo's admonition. It would be a bitter lesson, no doubt of that.
"I don't understand you at all," she said.
"Yet you are committed to doing just that."
"Am I?"
"How else can you give me something of value in exchange for what I give you?"
"What do you give me?"
All of the bitterness was there and a hint of the spice from her dried food. "I give you this opportunity to be alone with me, to share with me. And you spend this time without concern. You waste it."
"What about possessions?" she demanded.
He heard fatigue in her voice, the water message beginning to scream within her. "They were magnificently alive in the old days, those Fremen," he said, "and their eye for beauty was limited to that which was useful. I never met a greedy Fremen."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"In the old days, everything you took into the desert was a necessity, and that was all you took. Your life is no longer free of possessions, Siona, or you would not have asked about a signal device."
"Why isn't a signal device necessary?"
"It would teach you nothing." He moved out around her along the track indicated by the pointers. "Come, let us use this night to our profit." She came hurrying up to walk beside his cowled face.
"What happens if I don't learn your damned lesson?"
"You'll probably die," he said. That silenced her for a time. She trudged along beside him with only an occasional sideward glance, ignoring the worm body, concentrating on the visible remnants of his humanity. After a time, she said,
"The fish speakers told me that you ordered the mating from which I was born."
"That's true."
"They say you keep records and that you order these Atreides matings for your own purposes."
"That also is true."
"Then the oral history is correct."
"I thought you believed the oral history without question."
She was on a single track, though.
"What if one of us objects when you order a mating?"
"I allow a wide latitude, just as long as there are the children I have ordered."
"Ordered?"
She was outraged.
"That's what I do."
"You can't creep into every bedroom or follow every one of us every minute of our lives. How do you know your orders are obeyed?"
"I know."
"Then you know I'm not going to obey you."
"Are you thirsty, Siona?"
She was startled.
"What?"
"Thirsty people speak of water, not of sex."
Still, she did not seal her mouth flap, and he thought, Atreides' passions always did run strong, even at the expense of reason. Within 2 hours they came down out of the dunes onto a wind-scarred flat of pebbles. Leto moved onto it, Siona close to his side. She looked frequently at the pointers. Both moons were low on the horizon now, and their light cast long shadows behind every boulder. In some ways, Leto found such places more comfortable to traverse than the sand. Solid rock was a better heat conductor than sand. He could flatten himself against the rock and ease the working of his chemical factories. Pebbles and even sizable rocks did not impede him. Siona had more trouble here, though, and almost turned an ankle several times. The flatland could be a very trying place for humans unaccustomed to it, he thought. If they stayed close to the ground, they saw only the great emptiness, an eerie place especially in moonlight. Dunes at a distance which seemed not to change as the traveller moved. Nothing anywhere except the seemingly eternal wind, a few rocks, and, when they looked upward, stars without mercy. This was the desert of the desert.
"Here's where Fremen music acquired its eternal loneliness," he said, "not up on the dunes. Here's where you really learn to think that heaven must be the sound of running water and relief, any relief, from that endless wind."
Even this did not remind her of that face flap. Leto began to despair. Morning found them far out on the flat. Leto stopped beside three large boulders, all piled against each other, one of them taller even than his back. Siona leaned against him for a moment, a gesture which restored Leto's hopes somewhat. She pushed herself away presently and clambered up onto the highest boulder. He watched her turn up there, examining the landscape. Without even looking at it, Leto knew what she saw. Blowing sand like fog on the horizon obscured the rising sun. For the rest, there was only the flat and the wind. The rock was cold beneath him with the chill of a desert morning. The cold made the air much drier, and he found it more pleasant. Without Siona, he would have moved on. But she was visibly exhausted. She leaned against him once more when she came down from the rock, and it was almost a minute before he realized that she was listening.
"What do you hear?"
he asked. She spoke sleepily.
"You rumble inside."
"The fire never goes completely out."
This interested her. She pushed herself away from his side and came around to look into his face.
"Fire?"
"Every living thing has a fire within it. Some slow, some very fast. Mine is hotter than most."
She hugged herself against the chill.
"Then you're not cold here?"
"No. But I can see that you are."
He pulled his face partly into its cowl and created a depression at the bottom arc of his first segment.
"It's almost like a hammock," he said, looking down. "If you curl up there, you will be warm."
Without hesitating, she accepted his invitation. Even though he had prepared her for it, he found the trusting response touching. He had to fight against a feeling of pity far stronger than any he had experienced before knowing Hui. There could be no room for pity out here, though, he told himself. Siona was betraying clear signs that she would more than likely die here. He had to prepare himself for disappointment. Siona shielded her face with an arm, closed her eyes, and went to sleep. Nobody has ever had as many yesterdays as I have had, he reminded himself. From the popular human viewpoint, he knew that the things he did here could only appear cruel and callous. He was forced now to strengthen himself by retreating into his memories, deliberately selecting mistakes of our common past. First-hand access to human mistakes was his greatest strength now. Knowledge of mistakes taught him long-term corrections. He had to be constantly aware of consequences. If consequences were lost or concealed, lessons were lost. But the closer he came to being a sandworm, the harder he found it to make decisions which others would call inhuman. Once he had done it with ease. As his humanity slipped away, though, he found himself filled with more and more human concerns.
In the cradle of our past, I lay upon my back in a cave so shallow I could penetrate it only by squirming, not by crawling. There, by the dancing light of a resin torch, I drew upon walls and ceiling the creatures of the hunt and the souls of my people. How illuminating it is to peer backward through a perfect circle at that ancient struggle for the visible moment of the soul. All time vibrates to that call. Here I am. With a mind informed by artist giants who came afterward, I peer at handprints and flowing muscles drawn upon the rock with charcoal and vegetable dyes. How much more we are than mere mechanical events. And my anti-civil self demands, why is it that they do not want to leave the cave? The Stolen Journals.
The invitation to attend Moneo in his workroom came to Idaho late in the afternoon. All day, Idaho had sat upon the sling couch of his quarters, thinking. Every thought radiated outward from the ease with which Moneo had spilled him onto the corridor floor that morning.
You're just an older model.
With every thought, Idaho felt himself diminished. He sensed the will to live as it faded, leaving ashes where his anger had burned itself out. I am the conveyance of some useful sperm and nothing more, he thought. It was a thought which invited either death or hedonism. He felt himself impaled on a thorn of chance with irritating forces pecking at him from all sides. The young messenger in her neat blue uniform was merely another irritation. She entered at his low-voiced response to her knock, and she stopped under the arched portal from his anteroom, hesitating until she had assessed his mood. How quickly the word travels, he thought. He saw her there, framed in the portal, a projection of fish speaker essence, more voluptuous than some, but no more blatantly sexual. The blue uniform did not conceal graceful hips, firm breasts. He looked up at her puckish face under a brush of blonde hair, acolyte cut.
Moneo sends me to inquire after you, she said. He asks that you attend him in his workroom.
Idaho had seen that workroom several times, but still remembered it best from his first view of it. He had known on entering the room that it was where Moneo spent most of his time. There was a table of dark brown wood streaked by fine golden graining, a table about 2 meters by 1 meter and set low on stubby legs in the midst of grey cushions. The table had struck Idaho as something rare and expensive, chosen for a single accent. It and the cushions, which were the same grey as floor, walls, and ceiling, were the only furnishings. Considering the power of its occupant, the room was small, no more than 5 meters by 4, but with a high ceiling. Light came from 2 slender glazed windows opposite each other on the narrower walls. The windows looked out from a considerable height, one onto the northwest fringes of the Sarir and the bordering green of the Forbidden Forest, the other providing a southwest view over rolling dunes. Contrast. The table had put an interesting accent on this initial thought. The surface had appeared as an arrangement demonstrating the idea of clutter. Thin sheets of crystal paper lay scattered across the surface, leaving only glimpses of the wood grain underneath. Fine printing covered some of the paper. Idaho recognized words in Galak, and 4 other languages, including the rare transite tongue of Perth. Several sheets of the paper revealed plan drawings, and some were scrawled with black strokes of brush script in the bold style of the Bene Gesserit. Most interesting of all had been 4 rolled white tubes about a meter long, Tri-D printouts from an illegal computer. He had suspected the terminal lay concealed behind a panel in one of the walls. The young messenger from Moneo cleared her throat to awaken Idaho from his reverie.
"What response shall I return to Moneo?" she asked.
Idaho focused on her face.
"Would you like me to impregnate you?" he asked.
"Commander!"
She was obviously shocked, not so much by his suggestion as by its non sequitur intrusion.
"Ah, oh, yes," Idaho said. "Moneo. What shall we tell Moneo?"
"He awaits your reply, Commander."
"Is there really any point in my responding?"
Idaho asked.
"Moneo told me to inform you that he wishes to confer with both you and the Lady Hui together."
Idaho sensed a vague arousal of interest.
"Hui is with him?"
"She has been summoned, Commander."
The messenger cleared her throat once more.
"Would the Commander wish me to visit him here later tonight?"
"No.
Thank you anyway. I've changed my mind." He thought she concealed her disappointment well, but her voice came out stiffly formal.
"Shall I say that you will attend Moneo?"
"Do that."
He waved her away. After she had gone, he considered just ignoring the summons. Curiosity grew in him, though. Moneo wanted to talk to him with Hui present. Why? Did he think this would bring Idaho running? Idaho swallowed. When he thought of Hui, the emptiness in his breast became full. The message